You're listening to the National Economist Club podcast. For additional details and for slides and related materials, please go to www.national-economist.org.
Our lunch today, as you all know, is on CBO's Budget and Economic Outlook. For those of you who may want copies of it, it is available on our website at www.cbo.gov. I wasn't going to go through a full introduction of Peter, but I noticed there are a lot of new faces here, people that may not know him quite so well, including a few new journalists on the beat, and so I thought I would introduce you to my boss. Peter first worked on Capitol Hill in 1987 when he was an intern as a senior in high school for the former Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, who was a freshman senator at that time. Peter went back to school. He later graduated summa cum laude with a degree in economics from Princeton University. And he earned master's and PhD degrees also in economics from the London School of Economics, where he was a Marshall Scholar. In 1993, Peter came back to Washington to work for Alan Blinder, who had been one of his professors when he was at Princeton. This was the first of several appointments that he had at the Council of Economic Advisers. He was a staff economist, senior advisor, and then senior economist. In 1997 and the year after, he served as the special assistant to the president for economic policy and also as the senior economic advisor at the National Economic Council. He was back in the private sector for a while and then joined the Brookings Institution, as many of you know, as a senior fellow and deputy director of economic studies. He held four positions while he was at Brookings. He was the director of the Hamilton Project, and for those of you not familiar with that organization, they provide a platform for scholars who want to offer proposals to deal with broad-based economic growth and other related issues. He also was the director of the Retirement Security Project, which focuses on retirement security, and co-director of the Tax Policy Center, which was a joint venture with the Urban Institute, which provides tax analysis. Peter has written many books. He's a prolific writer, and they all have great titles, such as Protecting the Homeland, Aging Gracefully, Ideas to Improve Retirement Security, and Saving Social Security, a Balanced Approach. Peter was at Brookings when Senator Conrad asked him to come and lead the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan independent agency that provides budget advice to the Congress. He is our seventh director, and he has now completed the first year in his four-year term. We at CBO had two early clues that Peter would be a really terrific CBO director. The first was when he quoted Hedrick Smith, who in his book, The Power Game, wrote that creating the Congressional Budget Office was the most important step that Congress had taken in decades to assert its power. The second was when Peter showed up at his first CBO-wide social event with a giant CBO logo bullet tattooed on his arm temporarily. and I have pictures to prove it. We knew then that Peter would be a great leader for CBO, and he has demonstrated that by taking the lead in directing the nation's attention and the attention of our Congress to the coming wave of demand for healthcare spending that somehow must be addressed. So, at this time, it's my privilege to work for and to introduce you to my boss, CBO Director Peter Orszag.
Okay. Thank you, Melissa. I do like to say whenever anyone mentions the book Aging Gracefully that I continue to receive grumpy emails from people who buy the book and think that I'm teaching them or we were writing about how one could age gracefully as opposed to retirement policies, and it was not my fault. Someone chose the title, but if you are one of those grumpy readers, I apologize. I'm going to talk about our budget and economic outlook, but I imagine that there will be lots of interest both in what we can possibly do about long-term healthcare spending, which is the key to our fiscal future, and also in the short term about various so-called stimulus measures, so I'll try to leave plenty of time for that discussion and kind of breeze through this fairly quickly. As you all know, the economy has been buffeted by several interlinked shocks involving the housing market, where we have already seen price declines and troubles in the mortgage markets. In addition, there has been an increase in energy prices, and even though the economic impact of a given increase in energy prices is now less severe than it was in the 1970s, the increase in energy prices is still a drag on the economy. The combination of financial market turmoil and troubles in the housing market and the influence of those higher energy prices does seem to be manifesting itself in some indicators of economic activity, including the unemployment rate and including the most recent figures on gross domestic product growth during the fourth quarter of last year, for example. As this chart suggests, we'll have new numbers tomorrow, but the data that we had from last month on the unemployment rate suggested that there was an increase of 0.4 percentage points in the three-month moving average unemployment rate relative to a year previous, and that tends to be associated, as you can see in this graph, with recessions, which are the dark areas of the graph. I would note, though, that there does seem to be something different about the labor market this time around than during some of those past experiences. Whenever the unemployment rate has gone up that much in the past, we've also experienced a very significant, perhaps 20% or so, increase in unemployment insurance claims, and that has not happened this time. So it may be that this signal is perhaps different than it was in the past, and there is a puzzle in the disconnect between, again, the unemployment data that we have from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the unemployment insurance claims data that we're receiving. We could talk more about that. Somewhat brighter side of the economy is that we have been running very large current account deficits, and part of the adjustment, the longer-term adjustment to reducing those current account deficits, those external deficits, involves a depreciation of the dollar, which thus far has been gradual and has led to, or has, along with growth abroad, fueled rapid export growth, which has been providing support to the economy thus far. And as you can see, the current account balance has stabilized and actually somewhat improved as a share of the economy, largely because of that rapid net export growth. You put all those things together, and our bottom line is that the risk of a recession is significantly elevated relative to normal economic conditions, but that our best guess is for sluggish growth as opposed to outright recession. And I would note that most, during 2008, most forecasts that are based on formal macroeconometric models are still in that kind of position of sluggish growth as opposed to outright recession. And the economists and others who are increasing the probability of a recession beyond that are typically saying that the models are leaving something out. And it is important to realize that at times like this, psychology and perception can have a marked effect on real economic activity, in a sense becoming self-fulfilling prophecies, if you will. We are already seeing some of the slowing of economic activity in revenue collections, in particular, most notably in corporate income tax revenue. It's worth noting that corporate income tax revenue accounted for a very large share of the improvement in the fiscal position of the United States between 2003 and 2006, during which time corporate revenue rose from 1.2% of GDP to 2.7% of GDP, which is truly a stunning increase and I think worthy of more examination and more attention than it has received. But since 2007, corporate income tax revenue has started to slow, and in fact we now believe that January will be, I believe, the seventh month in a row in which there are year-over-year declines in corporate income tax revenue. And for fiscal year 2008, we actually project a slight decline in nominal dollars in corporate income tax revenue relative to 2007. In any case, we're also projecting for the rest of receipts some slowing relative to 2007, and that, along with other factors, will push up the budget deficit to some degree. Oops, I went the wrong way. To a projected $219 billion, which I want to immediately provide a little bit more context about. Our baseline projections assume current law, so anything that the Congress has not yet done is not in there, even if you think the Congress will do it. In particular, for example, there is very likely to be roughly another $100 billion or so appropriated for the ongoing war in Iraq and Afghanistan. About $30 billion of that is likely to spend out this year. So instead of 219, you'd get up to something like 250. If we wind up having a recession instead of an outright recession instead of sluggish growth, the deficit would be larger than that. And if policymakers, in an attempt to reduce the severity or probability of that recession, adopted a stimulus package, it could be larger still. All told, it is not implausible that if we do experience a recession, and I want to emphasize that our central estimate is that we won't, but that the odds of one occurring is elevated. And if there were stimulus measures taken to try to mitigate the impact of that recession, we could easily hit a $500 billion deficit this fiscal year. Thereafter, we project under our baseline a significant improvement in the fiscal outlook. But basically, most people who follow budget matters don't really believe our baseline because it does assume that current law doesn't change, and therefore it assumes things like that the alternative minimum tax gradually takes over the tax code. And it is very likely, according to most policy observers, that there will be some policy changes undertaken in order to avoid that kind of outcome. So if instead of following the various assumptions of our baseline, which assumes that the AMT does grow rapidly, it assumes that all of the 2001 and 2003 tax legislation expires as scheduled at the end of 2010, it assumes that discretionary spending falls from 7.6% of GDP last year to 6.1% of GDP by 2018. If instead of adopting those kinds of assumptions, you adopt an alternative set of assumptions in which the AMT is reformed so that it doesn't hit a larger share of the population, in which the 2001 and 2003 tax legislation is extended past its current expiration, and basically, I can provide a little bit more detail, but basically discretionary spending keeps pace with GDP instead of just with inflation, so that the share of GDP spent on discretionary spending is basically flatlined, you wind up with the bottom dotted line instead of the top line, which is our baseline. So a much different outlook over the next 10 years under that alternative set of policy changes. Furthermore, even within the 10-year budget window, the growing drumbeat of our longer-term fiscal pressures are starting to manifest themselves. The number of beneficiaries on Social Security will rise from about 50 million to more than 60 million over the next decade. That increase in caseload will also occur in Medicare, but the increase in the number of beneficiaries, while it does drive up spending, is not the primary explanation for why spending on these programs increases even over the next decade. And you can kind of see that from the fact that over the next decade, Medicare and Medicaid spending goes up a lot more than Social Security. As a share of the economy, they go from 4.6 to 5.9% of the economy, so an increase of 1.3 percentage points. Over the same period of time, Social Security goes up by 0.6% of GDP. So roughly twice as much an increase in Medicare and Medicaid than in Social Security, even though in terms of beneficiary roles, the demographic things that are affecting Social Security are also affecting especially the Medicare program. And that's because most of the cost increases that are projected out into the future have to do with rising cost per beneficiary rather than a greater number of beneficiaries, even though that does also affect the budget. And that conclusion is underscored even more as you go out over time, over, say, a 75-year window, where you can clearly see the health programs becoming the dominant force in our long-term fiscal future, much more so than Social Security, which is the dark area. Obviously, that light blue area has a much more substantial impact on our fiscal future than anything else in that graph. Medicare and Medicaid spending under our projections are expected to rise from 4.6% of GDP this year to 12% of the economy by 2050 and almost 20% of the economy by the end of the 75-year window. I should note that's not a prediction. That is a projection of current law. I don't believe this will actually happen, but it will require a change in federal policy to avoid it from being so. We can collapse that spending with assumptions about the revenue side. Let's focus on this alternative fiscal scenario, which basically takes the 2007 tax code and projects that forward so that the top marginal tax rate remains what it is today, or what it was last year, which is also what it is today. And similarly, the alternative minimum tax is not allowed to take over the tax code. If you combine that set of assumptions on the revenue side with the spending I just showed you, you wind up with a so-called fiscal gap, which represents the present value difference between revenue and spending, of 7% of GDP. What that tells you is to avoid an explosion in debt, you need to reduce spending by 7% of GDP or increase revenue by 7% of GDP immediately and then hold it there for the next 75 years. Given that both of those are roughly 20% of the economy or so, I will let you undertake your own probability assessment of the political economy of that happening. I think the divergence between the likelihood of that occurring, at least in the very near term, and the simple arithmetic of the path that we are on underscores the seriousness of our long-term fiscal future, most of which, again, comes down to the rate at which healthcare costs are growing. And I will end with this slide. If you take that 7% of GDP fiscal gap and you try to ask the question, how much is due to demographics and how much is due to excess cost growth, you wind up with charts that look something like this. The dark area there is the pure effect of demographics. That is, I turn off the rate at which healthcare costs grow relative to income per capita, and then I just age the population as we project, and I say, how much does that worsen the federal budget? And the answer is that dark blue area. If I then allow the population to, with that broader population, the effect of higher cost growth in healthcare is also magnified because you're then applying higher healthcare costs across a larger number of beneficiaries. That's the light blue area. There's sort of an interaction effect between the two forces. But I think you can see the bulk of the long-term fiscal gap is not coming from that. So yes, we need to address the nation's demographic issues, and they are serious, but we are, as I like to say, we have been very seriously misallocating our analytical resources in writing lots of books, including most of the ones that Melissa delineated for you that I did in the past, on that dark blue area, and not paying nearly enough attention to the light area, which has to do with the rate at which healthcare costs grow per beneficiary. And I think there are very substantial opportunities to reduce the level of healthcare spending without harming health outcomes through better information, better incentives, and better lifestyles that we are not capturing. So what's interesting and exciting is there's a very substantial opportunity, difficult to capture, but nonetheless real, to reduce healthcare spending, and that is the central long-term fiscal challenge that we face, without harming our health. And I think a lot of the reason for that opportunity existing is that we do far too little in trying to examine what works and what doesn't in healthcare, and we have a payment system that provides incentives for more care instead of better care. So we wind up with lots of care that, on average, is beneficial, but then gets applied in lots of settings where it doesn't add any value, it drives up costs substantially, and doesn't improve health outcomes. And the central fiscal challenge that we face is actually capturing that kind of opportunity. So the typical framing of our long-term budget problem of we just need to lock policymakers in a room and let them, not let them out until they've decided what from a list of options on Social Security or what have you they choose from works with regard to Social Security. Effectively, it works with regard to the dark area. It doesn't work so well with regard to the light area because we have not done the analytical work and we have not built out the information infrastructure necessary to actually make the specific decisions that would be necessary in order to address that problem. Or another way of putting the same point is you can lock policymakers in the room. I have not seen a single credible plan that restores long-term balance to Medicare and Medicaid in any rigorous way from which they could choose. So I don't know exactly what they would be talking about in that locked room. And with that, I will wrap up and welcome your questions. Thank you very much. Pete.
Last week we heard from Larry Meyer, and he expressed the view that the history of fiscal stimulus bills is that they only work to avoid recession by accident. What's the risk that the stimulus won't actually get out into the economy until it's just boosting the recovery that's already underway?
I guess I'd say two things. The first is the history of fiscal stimulus efforts in the past is mixed. There are lots of examples in which timing was a very substantial problem. It does appear that, serendipitously or not, that the last discussion about stimulus that occurred in the early part of this decade probably was fairly well timed. And it does appear that if policymakers can act quickly, that this one may turn out to be very well timed also. I don't know whether that has to do with the ability of people in rooms such as this one, or improvements in information technology, or changes in the policy process that allow a problem to be identified more quickly and then policy action to be taken. But it is remarkable that we're now at the end of January and there is legislation that is, you know, quickly moving into conference, basically, when only a month and a half ago or so, maybe 2 months ago, it was a very controversial proposition put forward in the Financial Times, among Financial Times editorial pages, among other places, that a stimulus would be even plausibly warranted. And that shortened time span may augur well for the time lag involved. There's a separate question, though, involved in having decided to act, how quickly action will be felt. And as I have said before, it is unfortunate, but it just the way the world is, that the combination of where we are in the tax filing season and the fact, through no fault of its own, that the IRS IT infrastructure is designed in a way that makes it difficult to do anything other than processing tax returns during this peak season, means that it is very unlikely that any cash will flow, whether electronically or through checks, before, say, mid-May. And the evidence also suggests that one might expect the biggest effects not just after one quarter, but after two quarters. And so in terms of the bulk of what the stimulus legislation is providing, the biggest effects will probably come in back-to-school spending and then Christmas spending, and not in March or April or May. And I think a lot of people, a lot of economists, would feel more comfortable if there were more stimulus being provided up front in terms of this risk trade-off to the economy. Certainly, as you move out into early 2009 or mid-2009, the probabilities that the economy has recovered by then go significantly up. They're not one, but they go significantly up. And therefore, the risk that you would be delivering additional aggregate demand stimulus when the economy didn't need it also go up.
Yep. Hi, Susie Webster, USDA. I have a question about this Medicare issue, and I think we've known for a number of years that Medicare is in a much worse precarious position than Social Security, and we've studied the Social Security and we kind of know what our fixes are to deal with that. But on the Medicare, what do we do? I mean, do we raise the taxes on that? Do we just let it go defunct? What are our possible alternatives?
Let me answer that in two different ways. The programmatic changes are not that hard to sort of dream up. So, you know, adjusting provider payment rates and changing cost-sharing requirements. And those would have some effect on Medicare's financing or Medicaid's financing. But there is a question, at least in part, if not in whole, a lot of those things simply shift costs around a health system without restraining the overall rate at which healthcare costs are growing. And ultimately, that kind of approach is probably not going to be sustainable if you want to maintain broad spread access to doctors and hospitals under the public program. So, for example, under current law, we have a very substantial reduction in physician payments that's baked into, by the way, all those official baseline numbers under the so-called sustainable growth rate formula. If that policy were actually carried out in full, and I would put very low odds on it actually being the case, but if it were, there is the potential for very serious access problems to doctors under the Medicare program. And one of the reasons is you're just clamping down on a specific reimbursement rate, if you will, or payment policy without addressing the underlying driver of cost. And so I think the real question is, how can we get at those system-wide costs? And I think I tend to think of things in four buckets of activity. The first is, coming back to information, much too little of the healthcare that is delivered in the United States is backed by specific evidence that it works relative to an alternative. So even on drugs, the testing that we do under FDA approval is drug A versus drug B. Drug A versus a placebo. It is not drug A versus drug B, which is what you want to know. It is not drug A versus drug B versus some kind of other surgery or other kind of medical intervention. And so even in the example that's often held up as, oh, we do a lot of testing, I don't really care whether the pill works better than a sugar pill. I want to know whether the pill works better and is worth the extra cost relative to the other medical interventions that are possible. And we do very little of that. And that's just in one area. But in general, no one can tell you, based on any reliable evidence, whether after your surgery it's beneficial to go back and see the doctor twice a month or four times a month, whether in many situations MRIs that are ordered for back pain with some indication of nerve damage are actually warranted or not. There's a lot of medical practice that doesn't have scientific evidence behind it, and it varies quite substantially across different parts of the United States. I was saying at lunch, if you look at Medicare beneficiaries in the last 6 months of life and compare UCA Medical and the Mayo Clinic, which are two of the world's leading academic centers and two of our leading academic medical centers, the cost, there's no difference in quality. In fact, the quality difference goes in the opposite direction from what you might expect. And UCA Medical costs twice as much as the Mayo Clinic, all in for Medicare beneficiaries on average, $50,000 versus $25,000. That is stunning. The American taxpayer is paying for that difference. And we don't have enough information about why that's happening and what we're getting in exchange for it. Because the admittedly imperfect quality indicators that we get suggest we don't get anything at all for it. And similarly, if you look across regions of the United States, there's very substantial differences in cost per beneficiary in Medicare that you can't explain based on the riskiness of the patients or the input prices in the areas, and that don't correlate with better health outcomes on average in the different areas of the country. And that variation is most significant often where it's unclear what should happen, i.e. we don't have a clear guideline or we don't have clear information on appropriate medical care. So the first thing is we need to very substantially expand how much information we are. The investment in what's called comparative effectiveness research, specifically what works and what doesn't in clinical settings. That's one thing. Just doing that, though, is not going to change medical practice that much. It may affect it somewhat, just publishing the results. But financial incentives also matter, I think, to a first approximation in healthcare at an aggregate level. We get what we provide, financial incentives for providers to provide. So we have strong financial incentives for high-end technology. We get a lot of that, and the report that we just released this morning suggests that the advances in technology, whether it's devices or drugs or new services, are the single most important factor explaining our historical increase in healthcare costs. And that's in part because we have very strong financial incentives for that. We don't have strong financial incentives for preventative medicine. We don't get it. So if you want to tilt the practice of medical care towards better care, you need to tilt financial incentives towards better care, both on the provider and on the consumer side. A third bucket of activity, so that's information incentives. Third bucket of activity involves delivery systems and how we organize healthcare. Whether more care coordination, physician group practices, there are questions about for-profit and non-for-profit hospitals, but basically the mechanism through which healthcare is delivered, I think there are important questions there. And then the fourth category is sort of not just a cost issue. I think we're doing way too little on helping people live healthy lives and making it easy for them to do so. There is very powerful evidence that from retirement saving and elsewhere that when you make it easy for people to do what they want to do, and most people say they want to live healthy lives, you get a lot of improvement. And when there's even small difficulties in doing so, it has a surprisingly large effect. So we economists walk around thinking that financial incentives and sort of perfectly rational decision making is all important. But I think in study after study, we are learning that how things are framed and how they're presented and ease of doing the default, you know, sort of what happens automatically, makes all the difference in the world. And basically all of our defaults are flipped towards unhealthy lifestyles, or most of them are. Mm-hmm. And trying to change that is difficult. I should immediately say all of these buckets are basically, from a political economy perspective, almost impossible to make significant progress on. But if we're going to get serious about this, that's what we need to be doing. And that's, I guess, what I meant by misallocating our analytical resources. There is so much more that needs to be done in each of those buckets, both analytically and from a sort of policy application perspective. And we're, you know, only taking baby steps, in my opinion. I will also add, that's fine for me to, you know, bemoan that. What am I doing? CBO is very substantially expanding its health staff, in part because of to help policymakers have more information and better analysis of these kinds of options. We've already moved from 30 full-time equivalent staff on healthcare at the beginning of last year to about 45, and there's more to come. And that's actually a very big change in an organization of 235 people. We're doing a lot more work also in trying to flesh out options on what might help. So in the kinds of areas that I was just describing, what specifically could policymakers do? And we're spending a lot of this year putting together two major reports on those kind of topics. So I'm hoping CBO will do its small part, but obviously the effort has to be a lot bigger than that.
Bob Walker, have you looked at this with your intuition and or any early study that would say which one of the four buckets might be the most productive?
It depends what you're trying to accomplish. In terms of improved health outcomes, I would actually, and this may surprise people, I would put a lot of emphasis on that final bucket. I think the evidence to me suggests that health behavior has a much stronger influence on health outcomes than the healthcare system does, and yet we spend most of the policy discussion on the healthcare system. So it depends what you're trying to accomplish. Within the healthcare system, I think the most traction you're going to get is from the second bucket, aligning financial incentives better. But you can't do that without knowing more, i.e. the first bucket and the third bucket, what you want to do and how to organize it. That second, the incentives are kind of the key implementation mechanism, I think, to actually driving change, but you need to know what you want to drive before you can do that. Or if we're going to pay for performance, we want to know what specific performance we're trying to pay for.
It seems like, from what you're describing, the incentives, especially the financial incentives, though it's not like stigma is attached to private insurance companies, they have an incentive to look at how alternative treatments work. I wonder if there is any information to glean from that, or how helpful is the experience there for the Medicare case, understanding that it's a different population.
It's a great question. So a natural response to this question of we need more information on what works and what doesn't is, why aren't insurance companies doing that? And partial answer is, some of them are. But I think a fuller explanation is that both because of the public good nature of that kind of information, and also because of the structure of our healthcare system where there is significant turnover, which both reduces the incentive for insurance firms to undertake this kind of research and also complicates their doing so, because if something pays off after 5 or 6 years and you're losing X percent of your sample, I know from experience trying to do follow-up surveys is unbelievably difficult, and if not, you have attrition error and other problems that can make it very difficult. Furthermore, insurance claims databases, which is what you would use to try to do this kind of thing, don't have quality outcomes attached to them. They just have, you paid this for that. You don't have what the patient's blood pressure or biomarkers or any other information about, I guess you can usually tell whether the patient died, but other than that, you're lacking the kind of information that you would need. And I think that underscores something that will be important, which involves health information technology. I actually think it's plausible that the largest return to a more universal system of electronic health records will not be the things that people typically talk about ordering fewer x-rays and what have you. And I can come back to some skepticism about the evidence of internal efficiency gains from health information technology. But rather that a more universal system of electronic health records will create the database or create the information that could be used to measure both inputs and outputs, because you would then have a wider array of quality indicators that you could also, or outcome indicators that you could use to examine this kind of thing. And in the absence of more widespread health information technology or electronic health records, insurance company efforts are also limited. Finally, I would note on that point that if we're going to examine things like should you go back and see the doctor twice a month or four times a month, should you do the MRI in this setting or not, what have you, it is implausible to me that we will do enough, that we will be able to afford or want to undertake randomized control trials on all those topics, because they're difficult to organize, they take time, it's hard. So we are going to be forced to, I believe, or I should be more specific, the medical profession is going to be forced to accept and live with the limitations of panel data econometrics that economists have struggled with for decades. And I do find it ironic that I believe the medical professional will have to move towards panel data statistics at exactly the same time, with all of its imperfections about not being able to control for everything and correlation versus causation, at exactly the same time that the economics profession, having grown frustrated with those imperfections, is yearning for more randomized trials.
The data that you show suggests that the medical care is the elephant in the room that will get most of the attention. And I wonder, everything else is more or less flatlined. Presumably there are some costs to the economy of things that the federal government will not be able to do in education, housing, infrastructure, all these other things. And I wondered whether from a CBO point of view, are you kind of examining what happens to the U.S. economy as the federal government is less and less able to do some of these other things?
Well, let me be more blunt about it. I don't think I... Oh, wait, maybe I didn't... Well, I can even... That 7% fiscal gap involves debt to GDP ratios by 2050 that are, you know, 300, 400, 500% of GDP. That won't happen. That cannot happen. That would involve economic dislocation. So I'm going to just answer your question in the sense that I want to underscore again, these are projections of current federal law when that is unsustainable. And the reductions in infrastructure spending and what have you are just one manifestation of the economic costs involved. This literally cannot happen. I do not believe you would be able to sell government debt at 400, 500, or 600% of GDP. So we are supposed to show the consequences of a path, but no one actually believes that path will actually occur, because it can't, and financial markets would force some adjustment before we actually reach that kind of outcome. And by the way, the economic consequences of those kinds of paths, if we don't act, are far more serious and far more damaging, according to any model that you could employ, than the current difficulties that we are experiencing.
I understand the arguments for trying to avoid a recession through a timely fiscal stimulus package, in that also, as you rightly show here, the deficit for this year would be drastically increased should we have a recession and go through that. But do you think there are any risks that we are kind of beginning to sort of get fiscal stimulus happening here in this country, and looking, and that forces us to look more at the short term and not at the long term problem? Also, the problem of negative savings rate in this country. Don't Americans need to save more? Is the government sending checks to all these people going to kind of send the wrong message? Also, internationally, when Latin American countries get into problems, is it going to be harder, for example, for the IMF, now the managing director, has come out in favor of this U.S. fiscal stimulus, to then turn around and prescribe something totally different, fiscal consolidation to other countries?
Let me answer that very good question in the following way. When the economy is experiencing an unusual period of weakness, as it appears to be today, the policy interventions that are appropriate for it are often exactly the opposite of the policy interventions that are appropriate during normal economic conditions or over the long term. So in particular, you know, when the constraint on economic growth is aggregate demand, that we can produce more with existing goods and with existing resources, you temporarily want to stoke consumption or demand in order to put the economy back on a growth path that is consistent with its long-term potential. But under normal circumstances and over the long term, the constraint on economic growth is not aggregate demand, but rather the rate at which that capacity is expanding, which is stronger or higher when you're saving more rather than consuming more. So you have this situation, and it occurs in specific policy areas also, of mirror images of what's appropriate in the short term and what's appropriate in the long term. And I think one can make a very good political economy argument that it's easy to step in, or it's a lot easier to step in when the policy objective is to boost consumption, and it's a lot harder to step in when the underlying policy objective is to increase national saving. Increasing national saving involves difficult steps. It involves, on the policy front, reducing spending or increasing revenue, and on the private side, it involves delaying consumption opportunities. So to the extent that what would be ideal, obviously, is to combine what might be appropriate in the very short run with a set of policies that are putting us on a better path over the long term. And I will have to leave to others to evaluate whether addressing only half that equation, the very short run, actually makes it less likely that we will be able to do the things that are necessary over the long term, because, as you point out, it could feed a reluctance to take those more difficult steps.
Would you apply the reasoning to the current monetary policy?
I'm sorry?
Would you apply this reasoning to the current monetary policy?
I missed the apply what to the current monetary policy?
This reasoning.
Oh. Well, I'm not going to do that, but let me say, let me do something else. Which is, if you take the FRB U.S. model, or you take the traditional models of the U.S. economy and examine the impact of reductions in the federal funds rate on real economic activity, the traditional kind of result is that you get about half the ultimate impact after 4 quarters and then maximum impact after, say, 8 quarters. Which is to say, if you then trace out, and I'm going to come back to whether those traditional lags may or may not be shortened in the current environment, but if you believe them, the various interest rates that have occurred according to those traditional lags would have maximum impact. The rate reductions that are occurring now would have every 100 basis points about a 0.5% of GDP impact in early 2009, and then another 0.5% impact in early 2010, which creates the possibility, at least, of a very short-term kind of air pocket of aggregate demand problems between now and early 2009. Now, there are reasons to think that maybe, and I should say, obviously, that's just with regard to the most recent set of interest rate reductions. The ones that preceded them will be kicking in somewhat earlier during the fall of 2008. And there may be reasons to think that those traditional lags are shorter in current environment. In particular, if part of the challenges that we're currently facing in the short term have to do with credit market turmoil and actions by the Federal Reserve, not only on the federal funds rate but also on the term auction facility, which thus far does seem to have succeeded in significantly reducing swap interest rates and basically the rates at which banks are lending to each other on international markets, the effects could be felt more quickly than the sort of traditional macroeconometric models would suggest. But I think let me re-answer the question in a different way. What is the argument for fiscal stimulus given that monetary policy is acting aggressively? And I think the arguments the intellectual arguments have to, I'll leave the political economy arguments to someone else. The intellectual arguments have to come down to two things. One is the timing of the outside, the monetary policy lag on the real economy. And the second is the policy mix, that coming back to this this graph of the dollar, if you ask the question for any given impulse to aggregate demand, would you prefer a real funds or a nominal federal funds rate of 1.5% or 2% with no fiscal stimulus, or a nominal federal funds rate of 2.5% or 3% or whatever with some fiscal stimulus? I think there are reasons to think that the latter combination may be preferable, because the risk of very significant interest rate reductions in changing this gradual adjustment of the exchange rate, and the risk of a more disruptive change in the exchange rate increases as interest rates, domestic interest rates, decline dramatically. And the second concern one may have about that, the exclusive reliance on monetary policy option, is that is one involving whether you're creating the conditions for future asset bubbles with very low interest rates. So those are at least the intellectual trade-offs, and then obviously policymakers may also have additional considerations.
My recollection is that the healthcare costs are about two-thirds of $1 trillion, and hospital costs about two-thirds of $1 trillion, and medical care provider costs and all the others another small piece of a pie. So that if you manage to find by controlled drug trials which was better and so forth, you wouldn't make a big dent in that whole big picture. But if you did on the first two, on medical care processes and on hospital processes, you might. Now, we don't have, as far as I know, anywhere in the United States system, a method or approach or a strategy or a place where R&D is funded to cut medical care costs. There's none at NIH, there's none in medical schools and so forth. The game plan is always to figure out how to get something done and damn the cost. So when you, most physicians treating patients have no idea what things cost when they prescribe them, because they don't pay attention to it. So if we were to change the system by doing systems analysis and operations research in those two big parts of the system, we might be able to actually streamline enormously in a very short time and have an impact, but we don't even have the capability of starting to do that through any formal process. That might be a policy decision.
I agree with everything you said, except that there is a very small agency within the Department of Health and Human Resources called ARC that does some of this type of research. We have put out a study on comparative effectiveness research that involves structures for how that a much expanded effort along the lines that you delineate could be undertaken. And there are questions about whether it should be part of the government, a quasi-government thing, how should it be funded, should it conduct original research, should it only do literature surveys, that kind of thing. And we go through the options. I think you're right, though, that in the absence of that kind of effort, yes.
you hear sometimes that it's normal in times of crisis for the U.S. government to run up high debt to GDP ratios. And also in the past, we tended to grow ourselves out of that, or we can help by growth and inflation, whatever that may be. I realize that, you know, what you're talking about in terms of future healthcare costs is another order of magnitude, and if you take in, you know, GDP growth estimates, but can you pull that up and talk more specifically about the role of future economic growth and firm growth policies that the government, quote unquote?
Yes, and let me be blunt. If healthcare costs continue to grow at the rate at which they have been, it is entirely implausible that we will grow our way out of the problem, period. I can come back to a more. Well, I'm sorry?
The war itself and the many casualties thereof, where there aren't fatalities, and the price of all of the resources going into caring for those people. Wouldn't that have a shock on that kind of analysis?
Well, let me answer that in a couple different ways. Well, at least let's focus on the healthcare part of it. Thus far, and despite what some reports have suggested, the impact on the Veterans Administration health system from the ongoing operations in Iraq and Afghanistan is not quite as large as you would think, in part because the vast majority of beneficiaries under those programs are still veterans from other previous combat operations. There's a separate question about, okay, roll forward and what will the world look like? And there are sort of mixed messages there. Obviously, for the soldiers involved, a lot of difficulty and pain involving injuries and being wounded. But it's also the case that the casualty rate is lower than it's been in other previous operations, and that in many situations, the medical care that's delivered immediately and also the protective gear that is sometimes available, not as available as many would like, helps to mitigate the severity of problems. And I'll give you a specific example. Some of the larger cost estimates for the veterans' health system that come from operations in Iraq and Afghanistan extrapolate the rate of brain trauma injury onto costs and can get very significant numbers. There appears to be, in many of those estimates, both an exaggeration of the rate of serious brain injury, and then what I'm going to get to is the cost per incident is typically based on, in outside estimates, not in CBOs, on things like what happens when people get into a car accident and they have a serious brain trauma as a result. And those are often very different than what happens to a soldier who's wearing a helmet who might still suffer serious brain injury. The cases are much different, and the sort of pathologies and the costs involved are much different. So significant problem, but it's also the case that some outside estimates seem to, at least based on our analysis, be exaggerating the ultimate costs involved, at least from a budgetary perspective. And I want to be very clear, I'm not trying to minimize in any way the costs involved for the soldiers themselves.
What I'm also alluding to is not just like hospital and physical, but emotional, mental results of having to deal with that kind of situation.
And those obviously can be very serious, and I think we're seeing at least anecdotal evidence of concerns arising in that arena. I would just come back to, at least thus far, in the kind of aggregate data that many of the heart-wrenching stories we read about in the newspapers are not as obvious in an aggregate sense when you look, for example, at the Veterans Administration spending. It's not to say that it depends what perspective one adopts. I guess that's the way I would put it.
I'm interested in your comments last year. Congress struggled with the president over the Child Health Insurance Program, the SCHIP program. And clearly, standing at the way Congress was going to do it, would add, at least in the short run. So I'm wondering, in the long term, with more children getting health care, whether that could have ultimately reduced a long-term cost or not.
Let me answer the question more broadly. It's often asserted that reducing the number of uninsured people will reduce costs, either immediately or long-term. And I think, unfortunately, that's unlikely to be the case. We often hear about emergency visits among the uninsured. And there is a tail, a small share of uninsured people who have very high costs and impose very high costs on the system. But on average, even at any given level of income or education or what have you, uninsured people consume less healthcare than insured people. And that's what you'd kind of expect. Then the question becomes, does their underconsumption of health services mean that over the long term, you know, that's at a point in time, over the long term, their lifetime healthcare costs are higher? And I note two things. One is there's significant movement in and out of that insurance pool, so it's hard to do the studies correctly. But I'd at least be somewhat skeptical that of claims that the increase in consumption of health services that are associated with being covered ultimately pays for itself. I think lots of us would like to believe that that was the case, but I'm not sure it is. The net result of covering more people, at least over any significant period of time, is an increase in overall healthcare spending. And then we as a society need to decide whether that's worth it or not.
What about the overall economic effect? People are healthier, perhaps they're more productive. Can you model that?
Well, there have been attempts to do that, not at CBO. I've seen, for example, the Milken Institute and others. And I find it fascinating that it seems to have sort of damped down. But, you know, as you know, several years ago, there was a very heated debate over dynamic scoring on the tax side. There's been much less attention paid to possible asymmetries in the application of that kind of scoring on the revenue and the spending side. That is to say, if I'm not embracing this view, but if you believe that higher healthcare spending led to better health outcomes, which led to higher productivity, that same causal story is parallel intellectually to the argument that lower marginal tax rates raise economic activity and so on. One last question. You get the last question. Our colleagues from Japan.
Yeah. According to the State Dominion, the economic stimulus package will create 500,000 employment, and it will increase the 0.7% GDP. Do you agree with this estimate?
Obviously, the economic impact of the stimulus package will depend on what's finally, if anything, agreed to. Those kinds of estimates don't seem unreasonable to me. In particular, a well-designed stimulus package could come close or roughly mean that every 1% of GDP in increased budget deficit with which it is associated translates into roughly 1% additional economic activity or GDP. And then the growth numbers that you mentioned, the employment numbers that you mentioned are also not unreasonable given that level of additional economic activity. All right, thank you very much.
You're listening to the National Economist Club podcast. For additional details and for slides and related materials, please go to www.national-economist.org.